I'm here in the Global Observatory today with an old friend, Colm Lynch, the respected longtime UN correspondent of the Washington Post, and before that, the Boston Globe. In addition, Colm now writes the widely read Turtle Bay blog for the Foreign Policy Magazine website that won the 2011 National Magazine Award for Best News Reporting in Digital Media. A man who has leapt nimbly from old media to new, he has more than 8,000 followers on Twitter. I should mention also that from 2004 to 2008, I was the UN correspondent of the New York Times, and I can tell you that each morning, one of my first chores was to call up the Washington Post website and type in the one-word Colm to see what my chief competitor had been up to. Colm is very industrious and very knowing about what's going on in the UN community and beyond, so there was maddeningly almost always something up to date to read under his name. Colm, welcome to IPI's Global Observatory. And first of all, I want to ask you, when you add up the Boston Globe years and the Washington Post years, how long have you been covering the UN?
I try not to count, but I've been covering it for the Washington Post since 1999, since June 99, and writing for the Boston Globe before that, I covered it on and off from the mid-1990s, so the end of the Balkans conflict, the sort of a lot of the revisiting of some of the weaknesses of the Rwanda operation. I covered New York as well, but that's when I started sort of peeking in at the UN and following it with some sort of intensity in the later 1990s. So it's been a long time.
Aside from how the UN handles public information, which I want to ask you about specifically in a moment, what would you say are the major ways the UN has changed in those two decades that you've known it, the ways in which its global impact may have grown or diminished?
It's hard to see it sort of clearly that way. I mean, for me, it sort of has ebbs and flows. And so it reaches points where it seems to be growing increasingly sidelined, irrelevant, and then it has a way of bouncing back. I mean, no one really could have predicted. If you looked at, say, the period from the period of greatest intensity during the run-up to the Iraq War, where, you know, I think in that year I had something like over 40 front-page stories for the Washington Post, something I haven't matched, I can't even come close to matching since then. And then, you know, you have a long period of enormous kind of confrontation between particularly Russia, Sergei Lavrov, when he became foreign minister, trying to use essentially feeling like he had been taken for a ride over the decision to go to war without a UN resolution, and an effort to try and ensure that any resolution after that would not be used as a sort of cover for military action.
Lavrov, of course, having been the UN ambassador of Russia before that.
Right. So you had a period which, you know, there was a lot of activity. It wasn't like the sort of days of the Cold War when nothing was happening, but it wasn't sort of the chief theater for international diplomacy that it had been sort of in that period. Then you look at sort of what's happened over the last year and a half and the UN role in overthrowing the leader who lost the election in Cote d'Ivoire, President Gbagbo, the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime. And I mean, when that stuff was happening, I mean, I couldn't have even imagined that that could happen, that the council could rally around such decisive, such violent sort of action in the world. I mean, they had sort of been operating under constraints that I didn't think were that could be overcome. And it sort of gives you a sense of how dynamic and fluid things are in the Security Council, how it can seem like it's doing nothing, and then all of a sudden it can become this extraordinarily powerful hammer. And I think people forget that. There was an article on the blog that Walter Russell Mead wrote earlier this week, where he was talking about the fecklessness of the UN, and he was using the inability to take decisive action in Syria and North Korea. And it looks that way, but you know, if you go back a year, it makes you realize that that things can change quite dramatically once a certain moment comes and arrives, and there's sort of enough political pressure to make something happen. So I would say it's all about ebbs and flows, but there's certainly big players in a lot of key places, and on Syria, the diplomacy looks unsavory, it looks messy, it looks perhaps hopeless, maybe not, but the UN is at the center of this for good or ill.
You know, another thing that happened in the case of Cote d'Ivoire, and I share your judgment that it was a really important moment for the UN, and Ban Ki-moon and the UN reacted in ways I could have never imagined they would do. The other aspect of that initially to me was, we talk often of the fact that one of the ways the UN is most effective is when it's working in concert with regional organizations, and we talk about the growth of regional organization power. In the case of the Cote d'Ivoire, you had ECOWAS really in there. You had three presidents flying into Abidjan to try to persuade Gbagbo to go. Were you as struck by that as I was?
Well, the thing that really struck me, I mean, ECOWAS and the Nigerians have been playing a security role going back to the 1990s. So they have been doing a lot of peacekeeping, and they've been trying to develop this role where they can play the sort of lead role as key mediator and key peacemaker. And you see it happening in Somalia, you know, African troops engaging in quite violent exchanges with Al-Shabaab. You see it you've seen a lot of that in West Africa, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and other places. I thought what was kind of interesting about this case was that you saw the sort of emerging power struggle between the Nigerians, who had taken a very hard line against Gbagbo, demanding that he had to leave, and the South Africans, who were looking to assert themselves in an area that the Nigerians had felt was their kind of sphere of influence. And, you know, there was a moment when South Africa, in a show of its kind of role in the region, brought one of its kind of warships outside the coast of Ivory Coast, which it said was there to facilitate the diplomatic process, but I'm sure sent a signal to others that, you know, maybe they were willing to flex some sort of muscle in the region. But I thought that was kind of interesting, that you see, as you say, the evolution of regional players. I mean, I think in the last year, you couldn't have imagined the Arab League having supported resolutions criticizing their own members' human rights records, supporting a no-fly zone military action in Libya, the role that they had been playing in trying to nudge President Assad from power and push for a political transition there. I think it's quite extraordinary to see them doing those sorts of things. I mean, you know, there are issues about, at the same time, the Arab League's credibility, the role of a number of very undemocratic governments in the Gulf that have been pushing the agenda, taking a much more assertive role, promoting democratic change in places like Libya and Syria, while at the same time not making much in terms of advances in their own countries. So, but it's been interesting. It's been sort of a messy process, like it has been with the African Union and ECOWAS, but it's been interesting to see them kind of stepping up to the plate in a way that you couldn't have imagined a year and a half ago.
Colin, you mentioned South Africa. After the failure 2005, 2006 at Security Council reform that would have put a number of people onto the council, numbers of those countries chose the route of becoming members for 2 years. The Germans did, Japan did, South Africa did, India did, Brazil did. Do you think they served their purpose well? In other words, was their performance on the Security Council, would it have persuaded the existing P5 that these guys really deserve to be on the council?
I guess it depends on what day of the week you're talking and which member of the Security Council you're talking to. So, I mean, I think that the experience for the Americans and the French and the British, from their view, I think that the experience has been quite frustrating. The Indians and South Africans in Brazil, they've been quite assertive and in ways that often don't seem terribly progressive. I think that the Indian position has been, I don't want to say squarely in Assad's camp, but they have played a role throughout much of the last year as a kind of one of the most strident defenders of Assad's position, characterizing the conflict very early on as a conflict between two armed parties. What is striking is that if you go back and you look at the early reporting to the council by the UN Secretariat, where they make it quite clear that they saw this as a largely peaceful movement that faced violent, brutal repression from the government in the early stages and then morphed into a kind of a movement with armed elements to it, you know, to the point where we are today, where there is almost an all-out civil war between armed camps, and it's now looking a bit more like the scenario described by the Indians when it hadn't developed to this point. So I think that their position had been not terribly progressive and was hard to defend. And, you know, I don't see a lot of evidence that supported their position in the early stages. Now, they have certainly changed their position since then, and they have now taken a tougher position on the government than they had in the past. So it sort of depends, you know, you sort of take a snapshot at a certain period in time, and now their positions are kind of more aligned with, you know, with the West, with the U.S., with the Arab League, and with the Europeans than it had been before. But you could also say that in some ways about the Russians and the Chinese.
Colm, I want to ask you about secretaries general you have known, including the Ban Ki-moon who is starting his second term now and the Ban Ki-moon who arrived here 5 years ago. Kofi Annan, of course, contrast the two, and then anybody before that who you got a good look at.
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is with Kofi Annan's role in the Syria mediation is that it shows, I really can't find an example of Ban Ki-moon and his team engaging in these kind of high-stakes diplomacy in the entire time that he's been here. I mean, it's something where the whole world is really focused on the UN as being able to either deliver peace or not and sort of wind up with a result that looks very nasty and ugly. So, and the interesting thing about it is that Kofi has almost set up an entirely parallel machine to negotiate this and to mediate this, all the way from the public relations part to bringing in some of his old team, Jean-Marie Guénot, others, you know, who have been sort of involved in his foundation. So, I mean, to me, it looks, I know he's drawing on UN staff that are providing backup, but it makes one wonder, is there capacity, some of the capacity for doing this kind of stuff, is it sort of shifted outside the building, and is it now sort of attached to some of these organizations? There's one in Geneva run by Jean-Marie Guénot, where they're drawing a lot of people from there. There's Kofi's nonprofit operation. Are these skills leaving the UN to a certain degree? So I think that's kind of telling. I also find, you know, there's been a couple of issues over the last couple of weeks. Well, let me go back to the Arab Spring. I mean, one thing that's been striking over the last year and a half is that you have a secretary general who has been criticized a lot for relying too much on quiet diplomacy and for not standing up clearly and taking a clear moral stand on a lot of big issues during his first term, the Burmese military junta and its crackdown on opposition in Sudan, his efforts to develop a close working relationship with President Bashir, who has since then become an indicted war criminal, that this willingness to try and develop a close relationship with these very unsavory leaders, he was criticized quite harshly for that. And you can see clearly his role emerging over the last year where he's been on the bully pulpit. He's been pushing a kind of much more progressive position. As a result of that, he's burnt his bridges personally with some of these leaders and sort of has probably limited his ability to play a kind of mediation role. Good reasons, his relationship with Assad has deteriorated. He basically hasn't spoken to him in several months, and he's taken the position that there's no point in dealing with him because every time I talk to him, he lies to me. So you can sympathize with that, but it also raises the question that, I mean, it's easy for us to sit here and we criticize him one day for doing the quiet diplomacy, and then the next day when he's not doing the quiet diplomacy, we criticize him for not being as relevant as a mediator. So, but that's part of the trade-off. And so I see in a lot of these issues, I think that the UN doesn't have the opportunity to play a go-between role. I can't imagine Ban playing any mediation role with Iran. He's had a very difficult relationship with the Iranian president, scolds him every time he comes to New York. They don't get on well, and I think he's probably perceived rightly for being much more in the American camp than a kind of completely, sort of independent player. And I don't think that that's changed dramatically since his first term. Kofi had his strengths and weaknesses, and one of them, which could be seen as a strength and weaknesses with the way we're seeing the mediation play out. Like one of, I think, Kofi's biggest strengths and weaknesses, the same thing, is the way that he kind of reflects the United Nations in all of its strengths and weaknesses. And so he walks into this mediation, and the first thing he thinks about is the only thing to get the train going is to make sure that everybody's on board. And so that means making kind of compromises with governments that take positions that one might find unsavory. I think that, you know, in a way, those kind of skills help the whole kind of diplomatic machinery move forward. But, you know, it involves unsavory compromises, and that's something that reflected, I think, his first term and what we're seeing here. So you could see two people looking. What he's doing is heroism and total acquiescence to autocrats.
Public information. My time at the UN coincided with the emergence of the oil for food scandal and increasing hostility from Washington. And the UN always struck me as being very defensive in the way it handled the press. Like any bureaucracy, it also harbored a lot of misbehavior, which you've always been good at exposing. Is it more transparent now than it was then? Is it more accountable? Is it more accepting of prying reporters?
I mean, if you're a reporter, you do your reporting, and you know, you don't expect them to help you uncover stuff that they don't want exposed. So that's fine and fair enough. I mean, I find that in a way, Bonn is more old-fashioned about the way he deals with the media than Kofi was, and certainly compared to the way that Mark Malik Brown managed the media when he came in as Deputy Secretary General and developed a whole internal infrastructure for dealing with the media that placed the whole public diplomacy at the center of the diplomacy. So I think much more for Bonn, the public diplomacy is something that happens after you do the serious work. And with, you know, with Mark, I think it was part of the same thing. Mm-hmm. And they elevated it to a level that hadn't been the case even under the earlier period under Kofi Annan. And also, I think that the usefulness of the public information infrastructure in the place is become more distant from what we do. So I think that under Kofi, there was a lot more information coming back and forth between the press operations and us than we see now. There's very little informal exchange of information. We don't, I don't rely particularly heavily on the press operation. I mean, I didn't before, but I did a lot more. I mean, I would almost daily have a conversation with Fred Eckhard, who would provide quite useful insights into Kofi's thinking in a way that I think that there's, I get the sense that, and I don't know, but I get the sense that Bonn's sort of inner circle, that the press people aren't a part of that, and they don't really know what's going on in the way that Fred used to. And that shows, I mean, one good example was when Bonn was under a lot of criticism before his reelection during a trip to China, where he had not made any mention to the imprisonment of Liu Xiaobo, that somebody had asked the question in a press briefing, well, have you guys spoken directly to Bonn over the last couple of days? And they said no. Maybe that was just communications and they were in Beijing, but if you don't have somebody who's, you know, that you're sort of in constant contact, then it makes it a little less relevant.
I find that sort of shocking, actually, because in my experience, and I think a bit in yours also, you've always measured the value of press secretaries or press spokesmen by what kind of access they have to the boss. This is certainly true in the White House. And I'm just amazed to hear that anecdote and the fact that they would even admit it, that they had not spoken for 2 or 3 days. A lot of your reporting, obviously, has to do with what goes on behind the scenes at the UN. But you're really good at reporting on crises and conflicts all over the world. How do you manage to do that while you're based here in New York?
Well, I mean, there's two things. And one thing that I used to do, I mean, this was really my focus when I worked at the Washington Post, is the one thing that the UN is really good at, it's like a central clearinghouse for information, for reports and internal assessments of what's going on in the field. And so essentially what you would try to do is you would try to weave a narrative on the basis of internal documentation. So that would be the way, if you were doing corruption stories on Afghanistan, or recently there were stories about internal assessment reports on the conduct of the Sudanese government after the referendum in South Sudan, when there was fighting beginning in South Kordofan. There were really gripping accounts that were coming out in terms of the treatment of UN peacekeepers by Sudanese security forces in Kadugli. And so you can get wonderful narratives out of that about what the relationship is like with the UN and these governments in these strange places. And, you know, there was a great account in, I remember, an internal assessment of the government in Ivory Coast's treatment of the UN in Ivory Coast in the months before Gbagbo was overthrown, and you look at this, and it's a great, I mean, I wrote it as a kind of how-to on how to completely undermine a UN peacekeeping mission, because, you know, they would, you know, it was very detailed. They would start a series, you know, they would start, you know, barricading certain areas, putting up checkpoints. They would systematically target certain peacekeeping units. They would do all sorts of things to basically put the UN into sort of a siege mentality and to kind of limit their willingness to go out and do their job. And you could almost see Assad's regime looking at a report like this and going, hey, there's some good stuff in here.
As Republicans in Washington look around for ways to save money, the idea of defunding the UN, or at least drastically reducing U.S. contribution, is back on the table. I think you were here for the last go-around when Richard Holbrooke, the then UN U.S. ambassador, succeeded in getting Jesse Helms, the UN's chief antagonist in Washington, to actually come up here and sit in the Security Council. How is that going now? Do you think it'll become an issue in the presidential campaign, defunding or at least limiting funds to the UN?
One of the interesting things about, you know, most of the Obama administration, the UN just has not been an issue. And I think even on the Republican side, most see, I mean, I don't think they could find a Secretary General who's more pro-American. And his whole kind of, Bond's whole personal narrative is very much, you know, woven into the kind of American story of the last century, you know, kind of survived on American handouts during the Korean War, the strongest U.S. advocate in the Korean government, supported the Iraq War, has supported wholeheartedly the U.S. war on terrorism. So I think that that has probably insulated the U.N. from a lot of attacks. Also, the fact that the Democrats have controlled both houses for the first part of his term. And it comes up, but it just doesn't feel like the stakes are as high as that they have been in the past during the Oil for Food program. It's an issue. It'll be an issue in the presidential campaign, certainly related to Israel. I think if there's probably not a lot of forward movement on the Palestinians' effort to push their statehood drive, that it will probably lessen its impact in the debate. But I don't see it at this point as becoming kind of a real hot button political issue. But, you know, on the other side, everyone is going through budget tightening, and it's not just the Americans. So you see countries like France and Britain, who are the ones who are, you know, yelling at the Americans, you know, you guys need to cut down this mission in Haiti, you need to scale back in Liberia, and we need to start coming up with an exit plan. And it's the Americans who are saying, well, hold on a minute, these are missions that we care about, and we want to keep funding them. So the pressure is more, I think, financial than it is political. And whether the two come together and create a kind of perfect storm, I don't know. But I don't see it happening yet.
Finally, you may have answered this question already when you talked about the run up to the war in Iraq and the number of front page stories you wrote. But if you had to answer this question, what is the greatest story you've covered at the UN?
The big stories are the obvious ones: Rwanda, Bosnia, Iraq. But to me, the most interesting stories have been not the big story, but narratives. All of the stories about corruption during the Oil for Food program, there were really, really wonderful stories. There was a terrific story about a UN employee in Congo who was under investigation for corruption. And you kind of looked at his track record and you see a story of a guy going from one peacekeeping mission to the next peacekeeping mission to the next one and always being under a cloud and somehow being able to just kind of keep moving around. There's a great story about an American peacekeeping official from UNOPS in Afghanistan the son of a former U.S. diplomat who was sort of overseeing like $1 million a day in funding to back the 2004 election. And it was a wonderful story of how these people with enormous power, very little oversight, and how the front lines of the nation-building venture and just, you know, how you could use this position to import all sorts of exotic, expensive caviars and foods and just the waste. They're good stories. There's a great story about in Afghanistan about a former British intelligence official who was doing demining in Afghanistan, and there was an investigation into whether he had set off a bomb under the bed of his Albanian colleague. And it was a wonderful experience just going through all the internal documentation. And there were feuds inside feuds. There was the UNDP would conduct an internal investigation, which would clear the British guy. And then OIOS would do, or then they would do another outside investigation that said that that investigation was completely manipulated and fraudulent. And then you'd have a third investigation and no one could agree on anything. And it was just sort of story of this like total dysfunction, but it was a great cops and robbers story throughout the whole thing. So those, I mean, to me, those are what's interesting about the UN is that you can get your, you know, you can sink your teeth into those kinds of stories if you have enough time to pour over them. I mean, the crime story in Afghanistan with the demining experts, that took like a couple of months to a few months to do that. So, which is a little harder to do with the blog now.
Colm Lynch, thank you so much for visiting with us in the Global Observatory.